The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today, my guest from Archive Wine Bar here in Toronto, Joshua Correa. Joshua, thanks so much for joining the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
By the way, I said Correa. Did I say that right? Or is it just Correa?
Yep, that's good. Yeah, Correa is good.
I second guess myself all the time. There's a few things I have less confidence in than when it comes to saying names, which is fantastic for wine, especially when you hit Germany. So let's just start before before your past and everything. What does this Saturday look like for you, Josh, with Archive?
Well, in a couple minutes here, I'll be propping open the front door, moving a couple tables right up to the front door, and just having people order in. If they, people who are walking by ordering from there, I probably, after we're done this interview, I probably have to check my computer to see if we've got any orders overnight, which I'll put together for people to pick up today. And mostly it's just going to be hanging out at the shop on a nice sunny day.
How's it been with deliveries and online pickups?
It's been good. I mean, that tends to be where we sell our higher end wines, tends to be through the delivery or through the online pickup. And then most of the people who have been walking into our restaurants have been going for the sort of walking customers are generally the cheaper ones.
I wonder why that is. Like, my first thought is, if you're by the internet, maybe you're already having a glass of wine, and usually you spend more if you've got a glass or two in you.
Well, and I also think, I mean, the people who are really into finding, into going through our list of stuff that we've saved for the last number of years and is probably not available anywhere else. The kind of people going and looking to spend $100 on a bottle of wine, I think, are more likely to take their time on the internet and search
right.
things through and what different people have and order that way. Whereas I think most of the walk-in stuff is generally just more people looking for a bottle that night rather than collectors or. Not that we don't get serious people coming in and buying just a bottle on whatever day, but I definitely do think that it's a little more. We seem to be more likely to sell the higher end stuff online.
What do you got right now? Like, if you were gonna try to woo me on a bottle, because right when you said that, I'm like, wait a minute, do you got like library wines? You got some older stuff just kicking around? Literally, my head made a mental note. Check Archive's website at the end of this. What do you got down there to tickle my fancy?
Oh, I mean, I've got a number of things. I've got some not inexpensive but well aged Barbaresco. Mm-hmm. There's lots of good Gamay and Beaujolais on the list there that much of it will have seen a couple years. I would say there's quite a bit down there or on the website and down in my basement that would sort of meet that interesting and, at least has a bit of age on it kind of criteria. Yeah. I mean, more I would ask you what you liked and what you were looking for and then see if I could find something in that range is generally an easier way to go about it. We had about over 500 different listings on our wine list before this began. So,
yeah,
there was quite a bit down there. And I was always of the opinion that after wine went through the LCBO paint shaker, that it should be rested for a good 6 months or so before you open it in the shop. Or, when we were a wine bar before even opening it by the glass for the wine bar kind of thing.
By the way, I like paint shaker. That is a good way of describing the process when wines are coming in from the LCBO.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even describe.
let's go back a little bit, Josh. I was lurking on your LinkedIn account, and I don't understand. I signed up to LinkedIn once. I've never done a thing on it. I feel so bad when someone says, will you be on my LinkedIn community? Like, I don't do anything. I don't even have a photo. But on yours, Bachelor of Science, major in plant biology in 2000. Did your love of wine come from this? Or did you love wine before and this is what you wanted to study? Is there any correlation between your school studies and what you're doing now?
I mean, there's, I would definitely say my school studies have informed how I've looked at wine. I mean, sure. I mean, to be quite honest, in university, I was more of a beer drinker than a wine drinker. And it was after university in 2000 when I moved back to Toronto and got a job working in a restaurant so I could make some quick money to go traveling that I started getting into food and wine more.
Okay.
And then it just sort of grew from there. But I mean, you don't necessarily, I haven't forgotten everything I learned in university. So, you know, it definitely informs how I look at wine. And when I talk to winemakers about, you know, how they're growing things and what they're doing in the, both in the vineyard and the winery to produce their wines, you know, my science background definitely comes in there as I'm asking them questions and I'm thinking about wines.
Do you have the epiphany bottle, or was it just, you know, slowly over time you became in love with wine?
There's been a number. I mean, I would say there's a number of epiphany bottles. One of them would be a buddy of mine went to cook in Europe for a year and he brought me back a bottle of Chateau Neuf de Pape, which I then saved for 3 or 4 years. And we drank it together after he had come back from spending another year in Europe cooking. And that would be one of the epiphany bottles, because I don't think I had drank a properly aged wine before. And then there have been others, though. There was the Pinot Noir epiphany bottle. And
we all have that. And by the way, good for you for holding off of that wine for 3 years. You get this nice bottle back from a friend, and you were able to hide it from yourself.
Yeah, I'm good at that. I'm good at hiding things on myself, which is why our basement is so full of wine.
It is one of these secret joys where it almost feels like free wine. It's so stupid. But I was going through, I've got a little cellar. I found like a older Grand Cru Burgundy. And I'm like, whoa, I totally forgot about this. I'm like, all right, free wine. Forgetting the fact that some point I paid, forgotten about it.
Yeah. But if you don't remember it, then it's like you didn't pay for it.
Yeah. I'm going with that. So let's talk more just about your place. And what I probably didn't do a proper introduction here is that Archive is the best wine bar in Toronto of great ones. We've talked to Annette Brulé from Midfield. There's a lot of great wine bars in the city, but what sets Archive apart is just the amount of selection. Before COVID hit, how many what was your by the glass program like?
Oh, I think we were up to about 40 or 50 wines by the glass. If you also if you included port and sherry and stuff like that, then we would have probably been around 50 wines by the glass. We had a lot. Yeah, it was always one of the ideas behind the place was to have a lot. When I go to wine bar, when I personally as a customer go to wine bars in other cities or something like that, I'm the guy who sits and orders 8 glasses of wine and then they go to turn to walk away and I'm like, oh, my wife's going to want something too. So I wanted to have something like that, you know?
Okay.
I don't necessarily drink the whole glass, but I definitely taste through, you know, I'm always into tasting that thing that I haven't tried before.
It's the best. And that's the great thing about your place. Like when I was starting to get into wine, there was Jamie Kennedy's wine bar as well at Church and Front way back in the day. And what I appreciate about these places is that you could try different things and sherry and port. And I think wine bars like yours are important for people where it's a sort of the safe environment to really go around the world and try stuff they haven't had before.
Yeah. And that was sort of the idea behind having so many things on the list, is to allow people to do that. Travel the world while sitting at my bar.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to leave Dundas. By the way, no one has ever given the dirt on this, but I'm always curious whenever I talk to someone who runs a wine bar, how angry do you get when you go into another restaurant and they say they're a wine bar, but they got 4 whites, 4 reds, an uninspired rosé, and the list never changes. I'm like, that's not a wine bar. You serve wine, but you're not really a wine bar.
There's no rules about what you call yourself. So people can call themselves whatever they want. It doesn't so much make me angry as disappointed. I mean, mm-hmm. I definitely pick the places I'm going to eat both based on what the food's going to be, but also what their wine list looks like, you know? And I think that if you're going to, I mean, let's call it what it probably is misrepresentation of what you do. And if you misrepresent what you do, you're going to end up with people whose expectations aren't met, and they might come to you once, but they're probably not going to come back. Just, I mean, so from a sheer business longevity point, I don't think it's a very good idea. Tell people what you are and be honest about that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Take me back to February 2012. I'd love to hear about the days leading up and the first couple months when you opened up Archive.
So yeah, we actually opened November 12th of 2012. February is when we first got the lease signed, and it took us nine months to get the renovations done and just, you know, jumping through the hoops of the city and the permitting process and all that. Has definitely led me to believe that I would never again take a space that isn't a restaurant and turn it into a restaurant. And that if I'm ever going to open up another one, it would be to, you know, buy an existing restaurant or at least rent a space that had already been a restaurant. Because, you know, dealing with the city, the whole municipal licensing thing is, you know, an exercise in bureaucratic futility. But anyway, so I wouldn't do that again. But then we finally opened up in November of that year and started selling wine. Started off with a lot less on both by the glass and on our bottle list, and slowly grew it over time. So at the start of the pandemic anyway, our cellar was really a work in progress for the preceding 7 years or whatever, or 8 years. And that just sort of slowly built. I'd buy a case, I'd sell most of it, I'd save three bottles, hide them away, not tell anybody we had them so that I could bring them out later on, kind of thing. You know, all those fun things. But it definitely was sort of, we started off a lot leaner and slowly grew the business out and added more options. In terms of wine and in terms of food as we grew.
That must be just so difficult when you're dealing with such a bear of a wine list that's changing all the time. But then I guess on the other side, it must be more mentally engaging and just to be, you know, to keep trying different stuff versus throwing out a different version of J-Lore.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. And, you know, I am not going to say that I do not have a wine and that I wouldn't have made sure to have a wine in-house that somebody who normally drinks J-Lore would like. But, you know, I also had to have, I also tried to have a lot of other things for the more adventurous out there. You know, I'm not much, definitely not much for sort of the imperialism of taste. I don't believe in inflicting my taste on other people. I'm more into people being happy with the glass they have. And if what makes that person happy is a glass of J-Lore, then I will maybe not have J-Lore per se, but I'll give them a similar flavor profile. Maybe something that's slightly better made than J-Lore, but runs along the same gamut, because at the end of the day, life's too short not to have something you like in the glass.
Damn right. You
know? And fighting with people to drink, you know, find fine bones Pinot Noir versus their most favorite residual sugar over oaked and extracted Cabernet Sauvignon from California is not.
What path would you take, Josh? Someone comes in and you know, that's what they've been drinking, but they're here to learn and to, you know, maybe expand it. So the person that drinks the J-Lore and springs for the Silver Oak on an anniversary, they want to go in a different direction. Where do you take them?
I mean, there's lots of places to take them. You could take them to a more modernist sort of style of Bordeaux, or you could take them to the south of France. I mean, you know, generally those people really like the big flavors and the extraction, as well as some oak. So, you know, there's various places in Spain you can take them that generally have a more extracted style and use more oak, like Riviera del Duero, or, you know, lots of, again, it also depends on the producer and not just the region, but there's definitely people in the south of France making big extracted styles. And I would just basically take them through sort of that style of wine. You know, I've become quite good at giving people what I call the friendly stranger, the familiar stranger, because it's something that's a lot like what they've already had, but different, right? So somebody who likes J-Lore, I'm guessing they, again, I'm basing my assumption on the fact that they like a big a bigger extracted style. So I would, you know, give them something that's also big and extracted, but has one difference. And then, you know, it's slowly over time, if they keep coming back to me, I'll slowly inch them away from their comfort zone and into a new zone. And before they know it, they're in a new zone, but they've never left their comfort zone in that whole process. So it doesn't feel like a big stretch to them.
Nice. Yeah. So
sort of my, you know, and again, like there's wines that I think that are good quality and are not to my taste. And I'm quite happy to sell those. I try not to sell wines that I don't think are good quality. But not all the wine I sell is perfectly to my taste or what I would choose to drink that night. And, you know, and when quite a lot, I get asked, well, what do you like? What would you drink? And I'll honestly tell you what I like and what I'll drink. And then I'll honestly tell you that, but just because I like it doesn't mean it's good or that you're going to like it. And it's more important that you have something that makes you happy in your glass than, you know, than you meet some predetermined criteria of cool or whatever.
Early on, you had a lot of Canadian wine, and you still do. It's a big, yep, big part of archives, of your inventory. What was the reason behind that? Because when you got started, I mean, it can be hard to sell Ontario wine now. It was much harder, yeah, when you got started.
To be quite honest, one of the reasons we have less is because it's, you know, it's easier to sell the other stuff. And I think what Ontario does best is recognizing that we are still a relatively cool climate, viticulture reason, despite the heat we get in the summer, and that wines made with a more cool climate sensibility, I often find are the better made wines in Ontario versus people going for the big extraction. I mean, there are some exceptions to that, but even the most ripe and extracted of Ontario wines, it's never going to taste the same as California, right? Even if we get a 2015 or a, you know, whatever the last great hot year that you can think of where the Cabernet Sauvignon fully ripened here, it's still not going to taste like Cali Cab. And I just don't think it ever will. So trying to make a wine that's like a Cali Cab in Ontario, I think just ends up with a lot of manipulation in a wine that's not as good. And that still doesn't fit the hole that people want it to fill. And yeah, I mean, Ontario wine's not the easiest sell. I definitely always try to keep some on because I think it's good. And I think there's a lot of good producers, especially in the last 10 years. We've seen some new producers and even some older producers who have really been on their game as far as making Ontario wine. But I think the best ones realize that we're in a cool climate and make their wines appropriately, meaning you're going to get a light to medium bodied wine out of it. That wine isn't going to satisfy somebody looking for a full bodied, really warm, ripe fruit wine. I don't know if I'm repeating myself too much, but basically, you know, I still try to promote the Ontario wines, but I've realized that trying to convert everybody over to them is not the best business decision.
No. And yeah, there's just some people that aren't. And if they're not into it, that's fine. My thing is, yeah, it's like, I don't care if you don't like it. No, if you like everything, you love nothing. So I'm totally good with it. It's just the dismissive thing I don't like. Oh, I don't want to have an Ontario red. They're all weak and soft and light. I'm like, really? Okay, well, here's Two Sisters Merlot. You drink this and you tell me, you know, or here's Pearl Morissette's Cap Franc. You drink Pearl Morissette's Cap Franc. You tell me this is light, you know, get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times, especially when we used to have a blind tasting flight. And if somebody would tell me, you know, just no Ontario wines in there, I do have to admit that quite often I would stick an Ontario wine in there. And then as I'm revealing what the wines were, and they were like, oh, but I really like this one. And I'd be like, oh, well, that's an Ontario wine.
Do they get angry? Have you had a bad moment with blind tasting?
No, I've never had anybody get angry because usually the quality of during blind tasting, the quality of the wine gets to speak for itself. It's actually one of the, you know, the big thing about blind tasting for me is I'm less impressed by the sommelier parlor trick of guessing what the wine is And blind tasting, for me, the best thing about it is being able to honestly, without preconceptions, judge a wine. To me, that's the real, that's the beautiful thing about blind tasting. It's not the, again, the parlor trick popularized by the Saw movies, I think is, you know, a bit of a sideshow, at least for me, in terms of blind tasting.
You know, you're right.
The number of times I've had to sniff a glass during service, not have any idea what the wine is and have to come up with the right answer on what it was is pretty much zero. I mean, I've had three glasses of wine in my hand and mixed up the order I put them in. But when I'm pouring those wines by the glass, let's say I've tasted them all 50 times and can guess them by smell, but that's simply due to my familiarity with the wines. Which is what I would argue that is actually being used when they do those blind tasting. The ability to do that is basically is based on building up a huge smell memory of different wines, smell and taste memory of different wines. You know, and if you stop practicing that specific skill of the blind tasting to guess what the wine is, I'm guessing that you start to fall off pretty fast on your ability to do it. Like, it'd be interesting to see the MSs who have had 20 years of being an MS, if they're as sharp in their blind tasting game as the young guys still trying to pass the test.
I got to tell you a couple thoughts there. One, you're right. The best thing about blind wine tasting is to just figure out what the wine is about and the quality and all of that. And you're right. I got my diploma from WSET years ago, and my skills now, would embarrass me. And I will say this, you're 100% right. It is a parlor trick. And it is sad, the satisfaction that we get. Like, I remember a little while ago calling it a right bank Bordeaux, and it was absolutely right bank Bordeaux. The rest of my night, I was beaming. I'm like, I shouldn't have been. I'm like, you have no reason to be this excited. You got lucky. It's sad.
Oh, no. And it's fine to be happy about it. And if I smell a wine blind and I guess it right, I'm also happy that I got it right. And I never want to quash anybody else's joy. I don't really see how it's useful in service.
Yeah. Oh, no, you're right. It's got to be in its right perspective.
No, and it's a fun game, but it's like at the end of the game, and it matters little.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day.
Yes.
If you're really good at guessing the identity of bad wine, like, what's the point of that? Mm-hmm. I find it more useful skill to be able to, from a very short taste, I often call it, like, if I'm at a show or if I'm tasting a lot of wines, I call it, it's like speed dating for me. Mainly because, you know, I'm not getting to know that wine. I'm just seeing if I want to get to know that wine. And, you know, being able to judge quality level and stuff like that on a taste, I think, is a more useful skill than being able to get the varietal and the vineyard that it came from and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Because that's good. That information is going to be on the label.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. At the end of the day, in the new world, it's on everybody's phone.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's on the app.
Everybody's got an extended memory device in their phone. The need to memorize and regurgitate large amounts of information, I think, is passing us by.
It is. Oh, no, you're right. There's something sweet when you get the vintage right. In an interview you did
I agree.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's cool. But you're right. It's fun, but it doesn't mean very much. In an interview you did with Good Food Revolution in 2013... Yeah. You say, if I was allowed, I would happily not only sell you a glass of wine to drink at the wine bar, but a bottle of wine to take home and enjoy with your dinner. Well, Josh, it only took 7 years in a global pandemic for that dream of yours to finally happen.
Well, and that's really been a lifeline. If we hadn't been able to sell food and wine to go through this whole thing, I doubt we'd still be around. Like, I wouldn't still be sitting in the shop for no good reason. That's for sure. No, I think this is major progress. And I know that there are people out there who are crying about how we're taking union jobs away and stuff like that. My retort to them is, LCBO might lose a few jobs, but at least my staff will be able to keep some of their jobs, even if it's only working a shift or two a week and stuff like that. I don't know. The whole, the sky is going to fall and Ontario is going to go bankrupt if we let a little competition to the LCBO take place. Seems to ring a little hollow to me and seems to sound a lot like, well, you know, all jobs are equal, but some jobs are more equal to me. So the to-go wine sales is definitely nice. What would be even nicer is a wholesale price for licensees so that we could, didn't have to mark our wines up above what the LCBO has to sell at. I mean, you know, most people are still probably not aware that as a licensee, if I go buy something at the liquor store, I actually generally pay 5 to 25 cents more, 5 to 50 cents more a bottle than I do as a private person. And then I've got to resell it and try to make a profit so that I can like pay rent and things and staff and the rest of it. You know, a lot of people are also quick to jump on the restaurant industry as being exploitative to their workers. And there's definitely a lot of that's gone on. And, you know, they point to Europe and go, why can't the restaurant industry be like it is in Europe, where people get salaries and it's a good full-time career type job? And part of the answer to that is because in Europe, restaurants can buy at a significantly lower price than the private individual can, and then they can mark up their stuff quite a bit. It was only sort of the biggest places with the most rip-off-y wine lists in the city that were charging five times their cost for the sale of the product. But that's pretty common in Europe, 5 to 6 times cost. But it's also because for a wine that we buy here at, say, $16, a restaurant in Europe is able to buy that at like €3.
Yeah.
And then they're able to mark it up and it actually comes up. So they're able to sell their wines at a comparatively lower price than we do here, but make more money off of them. And that money goes into making the business model of the restaurant more sustainable for both the ownership and for the staff. So if you really want to see a positive change in the restaurant industry and workers being treated better, what you should also be lobbying for is a real wholesale price for bars and restaurants so that we have the margin to be able to make the new economic model work. Because yeah. Right now, if you want your servers all to be paid $15 minimum wage, and have fair stuff, you're going to be paying, you know, I don't know, 50 to 60% more on your bill would be my guess. And you know, I don't know how many not service industry customers are going to be really into doing that. They already complain about how the price of things now.
Which is ridiculous. It's ridiculous because your margins are so slim. And, you know, the thing is more power should be given to restaurants. It's not going to hurt the LCBO. They're still going to make lots and lots and lots of money. And the amount of industries that touch every restaurant, like the amount of people that benefit if Archive is doing well. It's not just you or your brother or staff. It's, you know, it's wine agents, it's farmers, it's so many other people in between.
Again, if you look at most small businesses and where the money goes, the sort of profit, even if I was living a great life and making tons and tons of money off here, I still live in the neighborhood and spend most of my money in the neighborhood where I have my business. So it would just be going to, and I make a point of shopping at other small businesses because that money just gets recycled. Most of that money just gets recycled back into my own neighborhood and into my own city. And yeah, some of it goes overseas because I buy wine from overseas and stuff like that. But there's always a couple people local that are making money off of it before I even see it, right? Anyways.
Yeah.
I just don't understand how many people think that they're going to make the restaurant industry more equitable without changing the underlying economics of it. And I see the alcohol thing as, you know, a discount or a real wholesale price for bars and restaurants as an avenue for that to happen. Now, people are like, well, what about the tax revenue we're going to lose? And my point to be that to that would be, how about 0.1% tax, flat tax on all the dividends given out by companies on the TSX? Mm-hmm. That would cover, you know, that taking some money from the rich people would definitely help cover the cost of allowing bars and restaurants to have a more sustainable, you know, holistically sustainable business model.
I'm the converted. I mean, every Sunday or Saturday, I go to one of the local bottle shops and always buy something, and you know, just to help support. How is Archive? How are you guys doing? And what are your thoughts about the restaurant industry? Just where it'll be 6 months or so from now?
I mean, I keep making six month projections and then being completely wrong. So I've stopped and just taking it day by day. I mean, hopefully our politicians at all levels of government can finally get it together to get us through this. I mean, you know, I was always a big advocate of the New Zealand from the beginning of the New Zealand or the Australia, or, you know, a lot of people will tell me that they're islands and it's easy for them to close their borders. I don't necessarily agree with that, but Vietnam is as a country that also has land borders, just like Canada, has done a phenomenal job of keeping the COVID out. So hopefully, you know, Trudeau and Dougie and Mayor Aged Richie Rich can get their stuff together to get us out of this. But I don't know that in 6 months we're going to be done. Mm-hmm. I hope that I get a patio season. It'll be pretty bleak if we don't get a patio season. Even if cases do start to drop, which they probably should in the next couple of weeks, if the modelers that I follow are correct, I see it being pretty hard for them to allow us to have a patio while they still keep the kids out of school, even though I think school is way more a driver of infection than patios ever were. Don't know how you can have 30 kids at 4.5 to 5 years old inside eating and doing things and not expect to have viruses spread. I think it's a lot different than having adults outside with tables that are properly, you know, a real 6 feet between tables and stuff like that. I don't see that as being a real big driver of infection, but I think it'd be pretty hard for any of the governments to open up patios when schools are closed, because you'll get people freaking out. Why can't we've got patios open, but you guys can't open schools? I don't see that we'll have a patio at least till the end of June, just based on that. And full disclosure, I've got a 4.5-year-old. So before anybody gets on me about hating kids or not understanding, I understand fully and chose to keep my child home when they reopened the schools this last time because I knew it wasn't safe. Maybe not everybody has the luxury to do that. Certainly helps that my business doesn't need a lot of my time since there's not a lot of business going on, and I could do the schooling and take care of my son so that my wife could work during the day and stuff like that. And I definitely have some privilege there. But you know, sending the kids back too early is what got us into this third wave. That and, you know, our current conservative government not being willing to do what it takes to actually send kids back in a safe way, which would be, you know, like class sizes of 10 to 15 and other things like that. But, you know, ideologically, they're opposed to doing those kind of things and those kind of improvements to the education system. Also, because if parents saw the educational outcomes you get from having 10 kids per class, they would probably never want to go back to having more than 10 kids a class. Go check out, if anybody wants to argue, I would suggest checking out the Finnish system and their school system there and looking at how good a job they've done, both with COVID and just with educational outcomes in general.
I think, Josh, the only thing people are going to be upset with you is the voice you use to when you mimic. Right. I think
people, that's probably true. It's a very nice one.
And like no one ever does like a British accent. No one ever goes, well, I mean, if you want to say New Zealand or China, you can. No one does that. You know, you always got to get that sort of high grading voice when you're doing the mimic. And we all do it. Yeah. We all do. We all
it's
do.
True. The same. It's true. And maybe I shouldn't mimic people. I've just, you know, I'm a year into this now, knowing that my business is never coming back to normal until we're really out of this.
Yeah.
Like I knew from the beginning that until we get to a COVID zero or, you know, everybody vaccinated situation, indoor dining isn't coming back as a thing, right? You know, my capacity before this all began was 28 people. If I've got even if I have half capacity, which would be 14 people in here, that's not enough people to run. Like, it doesn't make economic sense for me to run my business like that for 14 people at a time.
Yeah, unless they're all buying that Barbaresco you mentioned.
Well, yeah, I mean, if they were all people who are looking to drink two or three bottles in the night, then yeah, that would work. But the truth of it is that we got many dates where they were just going to have a glass of wine each and sit and chat for an hour, and that kind of thing wouldn't pay the bills under the current capacity rules and stuff like that. So yeah, I've always been in the opinion that until we're done, we're never really going back to normal. The bottle shop alone does a good enough job of paying the rent and covering costs and the lighting and the staffing costs and stuff like that. But it's not, I wouldn't call it a business in that it's not something that is going to be profitable in the long run, at least without a wholesale price. The combination of patio and to go last summer was, you know, did sort of seem like it was approaching a real business. But yeah, I don't see a real way out of this until we're actually out of this, basically the way I've always looked at it.
And like, I want to go, like, I just realized the last time I was at your place was probably about 2 years ago. You were doing a wine release, a friend of mine, Andre, his damn Chardonnay. I remember, you know, coming yep. there, and it was packed and it was great. And I look back at it like it's some mysterious age. So I agree, you know, it's going to have to be a zero, you know, zero number before we all can go back. Before I let you go, Josh, what are you drinking now? And what is sort of highlighted behind you or on the bottle shop today?
Funnily enough, you say that, I just got the 80X Wine Company Pinot Noir Rosé, the 2020, mm-hmm. the newest flying pigs or pigs.
Oh, nice.
I just got that in stock. I think I have to wait a day to release it because I think they were still waiting on VQA approval.
Hey, there it is. There it is.
I just got in some of the new Pearl Morissette wines that I haven't tasted yet and I'm excited to try out. Recently did a little thing on Listan Negro and Pais. So I've got a Listan Negro from the Canary Islands from Viña Tigo, which I think is quite good, and a Pais from Garage Wine Company down in Chile. Both of those are interesting wines. I mean, what I always suggest to people is that they come in and chat with me for a second and we'll find a bottle that they like.
I've kept you long enough. It's a gorgeous, sunny Saturday. I'm sure you're going to be getting business. Tell people where you are, the website. Where can they find you, yep. both physically and online?
So physically, we're at 909 Dundas Street West in Toronto. And our website is www.archive909.com.
Josh, I really appreciate it. I'm wishing you nothing but the best, all the restaurant industry. Your place, Archive, is a testament. It is one of the best wine bars, if not the best wine bar in Toronto, just because of your passion and your selection. It's incredible. I can't wait to sit inside again. All the best, and thanks for doing the pod.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much for having me on. I hope I didn't make too many people angry, and have a good day.
No, I don't think you did. And if you and you know what? You got to make a couple people angry.
Right.
Yeah. Well, listen, you're never going to get 100% approval rating. It's impossible.
No, it's true. It's true. I keep trying.
Yeah, I don't think you keep trying. Thanks for listening to the podcast. You can find me on Spotify, Stitcher, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.